Well, the last time you were here was on the occasion of American Blood. What year was that, by the way?
1987.
5 years ago.
Yes. A long time. A lot of water over the dam since then.
What's happened to you over the past 5 years?
Oh, wow. Well, let's see. I've gotten divorced. I gave up the house that I lived in. I've published another one of my sort of photo essay environmental diatribe, Echo Doomsday books called The Sky's the Limit. I've, what else have I done? Stopped working on films. In fact, I was working on a 6-hour miniseries on the life of Pancho Villa and the Mexican Revolution for CBS. And at the end of the Writers Guild strike in 1988, we parted ways, but that was kind of a wonderful project. I learned.
I was on the picket line for about 13 weeks during that.
Were you really? Yeah, I know. Yeah, that was, what was it? It was a 4-month strike, or it was a real long strike.
Well, we settled early, fairly early.
Oh, really?
Well, wait, there were two strikes, I believe. There was a staff writer's strike.
Uh-huh.
And then there was a separate strike involving the freelance people.
The writers and the Writers Guild.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a long time. I remember being
on strike. But it was 88.
Yep.
I believe. Well, maybe it was 87.
No, I think it was 88 because that was, I know 1988 was also when two films of my books came out. One was the Milagro Beanfield War that was released, I think, in March of 88. And one was The Wizard of Loneliness, film of my second novel. That was released later in 1988.
I missed that one. Who was in that?
Leah Thompson, Lucas Haas, John Randolph, my favorite actor and political actor. Anne Petroniak. I don't know, it was a wonderful cast. It was a lovely movie that was shown on American Playhouse.
Also, it was a made-for-TV movie.
Well, it was kind of made, yes, it was semi. It was made for
theatrical American Playhouse is material that can certainly be released theatrically. That's such they do such a good work.
It was released theatrically at the same time, mm-hmm. but, you know, sank like a stone. But you can get it at your local video store.
You're still living in New Mexico.
Still living in Taos, New Mexico, 23 years, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, wait a minute, you said you got divorced and you gave up your house. That sounds a little familiar. Where have I read something about that?
Well, you know, the latest novel, right, An Elegy for September, has ostensibly a writer who's getting divorced, giving up a house. For the superstructure of one of the characters, I drew on myself because it was the easiest way to get into the particular mood I wanted to create. So that's where you've sort of heard of that before.
Yeah, yeah. So in Elegy for September, you have patterned the protagonist, if you want to call
it that. Superficially. I used, a writer because I wished to begin a relationship through the mails, with a fan. And God knows, in my lifetime, many relationships have begun through the mails in just that way.
Have you gotten a lot of mail?
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know, a lot of mail. Not like Elvis Presley or Tom Cruise, right? No, but I probably...
Literary notoriety is a little different from show business.
I would not say that I have any literary notoriety at all, but even in the tiny pond in which I flounder...
So what kind of letters do you get?
I don't know, 2 or 3 letters a day, usually from people around the country. They're wonderful letters. Many of them are quite political because it seems that my work triggers response from people, either in the movement or with some kind of a social conscience, people who are involved in the environmental movement, that kind of thing. But I do find that people are usually pretty serious. They're not hustling me very much. And I now have relationships with many people over the years that we write long letters to each other that are fairly intimate or fairly, articulate in terms of politics or life in general. And I'll never meet these people. It's kind of funny.
But you do answer your mail.
I try to, yeah. I used to answer it much better than I do now. Now there's... For some reason, there's a lot more mail that comes in, and there's always a couple hundred letters in a cardboard box, and about once every 4 or 5 months, I get desperate and make a form letter, you know, and send out a form letter and try. And I never have figured out how to have a secretary or get organized. You know, I've never figured out how to be an adult about those kinds of things. So it's kind of raggedy. But I really like that kind of connection. It's funny.
Well, an elegy for September, a young female fan, who's, I think she's around 20, something
yeah.
like that,
uh-huh.
writes a middle-aged author, and they develop a pen pal correspondence that leads to a sexual relationship when she goes to New Mexico to see him.
Right.
And stays, I believe, for about a month or so, uh-huh. something like that. Has that ever happened to you?
No. No, I never wandered around the mountains and the deserts and the gorges of northern New Mexico.
But you've never picked up on a personal relationship with a fan?
Yeah, I have. Yeah, no, I met my now ex-wife. I mean, originally she got in touch through the mail. And in fact, several relationships that I wound up in were with people who got in touch ultimately through the mail or just wanting to get in touch, you know, coming through Taos or meeting somewhere like that. Yeah, once I got a phone call at 3 o'clock in the morning, remember, and developed a phone relationship that was wonderful for over a year, and then we finally decided we'd become such close friends on the phone that we ought to get together. And that has turned out to be, you know, a friendship, not an enduring sexual relationship, but a friendship that's mm-hmm. endured now for about 15 years or whatever. It's kind of, you know, it's curious to have that sort of connectors or roots out into society. So
it's kind of scary, though, isn't it, to have a
you never know.
Anonymous relationship, and all of a sudden you see this person face to face.
Oh no, I think it's a wonderful, it's sort of magic, you know. I like the imagination anyway. Yeah, it's scary when you finally see somebody face to face because obviously then the real person intrudes. And what do they say? They say even sex is about 99% imagination, right? And but I don't know, it's interesting. It's probably one of the more interesting ways of coming together with people. I don't know.
I've been reading Mary Cantwell's new memoir called An American Girl. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It just came out this month.
Yeah.
It's about her childhood in Bristol, Rhode Island. And I'm almost through with it. And I was relieved in a way. Many memoirs will have family photographs in the middle.
Really?
Yeah. And this did not.
No family photographs?
No photographs. And I was relieved because as she wrote, I was picturing all of the people, her relatives, her friends, her enemies of her childhood. I was
sure.
picturing them in my mind, and in a way, I would rather live it that way than to actually see how they really were.
Oh, yeah. Listen, you know, I grew up listening to radio. You know, I listened to ball games on the radio. I started, you know, being a fan of, like, the Brooklyn Dodgers in 1947 when I was 7 years old. And, you know, with radio, you had to imagine everything. You know, when somebody hit a home run, you imagine the home run. You imagined how a play was. And there's something wonderful about that kind of thing. I listened to the Lone Ranger and Front Page Farrell and, you know, the Shadow, the Green Hornet, all those kind of programs. And your mind was working all the time. And I mean, obviously, I am not the first human being in, you know, modern society to comment that television has taken all that away from us, you know, and that there really is nothing left of the imagination, and every play is repeated in slow motion 10 times in case you missed it, right? So nobody really pays attention, I think, with their imaginations anymore. I was just in Seattle and saw a Mariners baseball game, right, in the King Dome in Seattle. And it's almost, because it's indoors, it's almost like you're watching it on a TV set anyway in your living room. But then there's TV sets all around where you're sitting,
mm-hmm.
right? So that if you don't pay attention to what's happening in the ballgame, it doesn't matter because they're going to replay it 5 more times for you. And the TV gives you a better seat than your seat where you are, farther away from the action. I don't know, there was something real appalling about that to me.
Well, I was in the Astrodome some years ago in Houston, and it's built in such a way that you're so far back that you really can't make out the features of the players' faces.
So did they have TVs in the Astrodome?
They have TVs over there because you look way down into the field and you just see little miniatures down there. It's not really adequate. I mean, there may be something fun about going to a ball game in person, but see, the old ballparks like Yankee Stadium, they're built almost vertically.
Sure.
So that the higher you are up, you're still relatively close to the field because it's almost perpendicular to the field. But these big stadiums, they go back almost horizontally. So when you have bad seats or you're way back, you can't really make out too well what's on the field. That's why they have those sets.
Kind of
wonder why bother to go at all.
I know. It's bizarre. The only time I remember really loving that was going to Rangers hockey games and buying standing room only in Madison Square Garden, and you're up on the 800th tier or something. But it was still a wonderful feeling, you know, being at the games.
You mentioned the old radio shows. I was talking to Robert Stone a couple of months ago, and he said the same thing you did, that when he listened to these old radio broadcast, it inspired his imagination, and he attributes a lot of his literary development and his ability to imagine things and to become a story, a teller, through listening to radio.
Oh, yeah. I would say the same thing for myself. You know, listening to radio, reading books where you have to imagine an awful lot of the action that's being described for you. Sure. I don't know how people develop their imaginations nowadays.
Now, in Elegy for September, we have the middle-aged author and the 20-year-old fan who comes to New Mexico and stays briefly. They have a rather torrid romance, really sexy book.
Is it? I don't know. I think of it as sort of a really gentle book that's full of, you know, just a richness of life, which includes a lot of sexuality. But they're also moving through a natural world.
What happens to these two people during the course of this month?
Gee willikers, in 25 words or less, what happens to these people? When I started out writing it, I actually had in my head it would be really fun to do a prose poem to just a natural season around my home, you know, in the same way that maybe Monet painted his lily pads and weeping willows, you know, in Giverny, in his home, those impressionistic paintings. You know, I just wanted to describe a mood, and I guess the mood was kind of autumn, and then when I put in the writer, who's the principal character, I mean, everything is pretty much from his point of view. I guess I wanted to deal with the human season, and what did I want to deal with? I don't know. I guess one important thing is simply accepting your own mortality. And the other important thing is sort of letting go of your youth when it's time to let go of it. It seems to me in our country we're so obsessed, you know, with sort of a fear of growing old and dying. We're also obsessed with a fear of not being young anymore, and people fight so hard not to to avoid, you know, the gradual breakdown of the body, etc. And I know myself, having a rotten heart, which theoretically at any minute, you know, could flatten me, I found that dealing with that, instead of becoming very afraid of dying, I became really accepting of it, because you kind of realize, gee, you really are mortal, you know, and no matter what you do, you're going to get nailed, you know, in the end. So you kind of quit worrying about it, you make a kind of separate peace, or at least, you know, that's been my experience. And I wanted the book to reflect that. I didn't, you know, reviewers have sort of said this is a book about a 50-year-old guy who really passes up a chance to have a wonderful relationship with a 20-year-old who's vibrant and full of energy and life and that kind of thing. And I didn't think about it that way at all. I thought of it as a book about a person who is very attracted to that cliche, right? Of the younger man, the older man, the younger woman, and then you know, but realizes instinctively that that's not what happens at that particular stage in his life. There's an epigraph, is that a little quotation in front of the book by the poet Walter Lowenfels that I sort of live my life by, that I really love, and that quote is, "Not to know and love the tragedy of your own life is not to know the joy of being here at all. And I don't know, I was raised by naturalists, and so I guess I've always had an instinctual ability to be tuned into the processes, and sort of death and mortality and growing old is just as much a part of the process as, you know, being born.
Well, we think about growing old, and my theory, and of course I'm a middle-aged man, older than you in fact, and my fear about growing old is not so much in terms of health, although that is a factor, but it's a fear of being left out.
Oh, really?
Left out, because I realize that I can look at the musical charts today, not recognize any of the musicians. I'll go into the record store and look at rows and rows of CDs and not recognize a single name, single artist. And even the artists that I've heard of, like Bruce Springsteen, I don't really know, although I did tape a Bruce Springsteen concert from the radio the other night and been listening to it, and it's a little hard for me to really equate to it. And I pick up New York Magazine or read page 6, and here are names of supermodel so-and-so, 20 years old, you know. And she's famous because she goes to parties, and discos, and things like that, but I've never heard of her. And that's what really worries me a little bit, that as I move on and my circle of friends move on, we don't keep ourselves up to date very much.
But that's, I mean, that seems to me like a natural part of the process. I go through that, and I've been a person who for years has kind of traded on the ability to have a macroscopic overview of everything, you know, to be tuned into everything. And I find it kind of a relief to be letting go of that, because you can't keep up with everything. And also the cliche that everything starts going faster as you get older, you know, and there's not enough time to do things. You seem to slow down and the world seems to speed up. I'm kind of fascinated that that cliche that I heard about when I was 20 and 30, you know, is really true. I mean, I feel nowadays that years just zip along and there's no time to write books at all. You know,
even the rotten years go fast.
Yeah, the rotten years go fast. But I kind of delight in that, and I also am finding kind of a delight in accepting the change of rhythm, you know, the change of speed. In fact, I'm real grateful to be training myself how to slow down and let go of knowing who all the musicians were. Because, you know, I was a musician. I was a rock and roller when I was 14 to 22 or 23, and I could probably sing to you every rock and roll song that was written, you know, between Blue Suede Shoes and Can't Get No Satisfaction or whatever. But I don't know. I don't worry about that anymore. You know, 3 years ago, one of the big moves I made in my life was to get out of a vehicle. I used to drive my truck all around Taos, New Mexico, doing millions of chores. And for ecological reasons, I said, this is stupid. And I bagged the truck, got on a bicycle, and spend about 70% of my traveling time now on a bicycle, you know, in the area where I live. And I also found when I was on a bike that I could only do about a quarter of the chores that I'd been doing before. And so everything kind of slowed down. And then I discovered that the other three quarters of the chores that I'd been doing were really senseless. I didn't really have to do them. You know,
what do you
really
mean by chore? What ecological?
I don't know. I mean, it's when you're in a car, you zip around town and you do this and you do that and you can cover great miles, you know, and you can meet different people and you can go places. Thinking back, I don't know quite exactly what I did, except I would go to the post office, I would go to a cafe, I would go Xerox things, I would have to go to Federal Express, I would, you know, blah, blah, blah. And
So what you're saying is you have, in a way, simplified your life.
Absolutely. Oh, God, enormously. You know, and I can't figure out what was so important about all the other things that I did before. It's a real contradiction to be flying around this country on a book tour for this very gentle, quiet, simply written little novel, right, which is mostly about sort of slowing down your life and the simplicity of the natural world. And I find it quite traumatic, you know, to be landing in all these cities. It's fascinating to me because I've been out of it for a while. But I don't have the thrill getting back into it. anymore. Yeah.
Well, I guess, as the author in the novel does, and well, my presumption is it happened to you when you had the divorce, you mentioned at the outset of this chat that you gave up your house. Now, this must have been, this is obviously a way of simplifying your life if you don't have a house.
Yes.
Because the author in the book, and I assume it's the case with you, if you patterned it, apparently had the house for 15 years?
20 years, you know, 22
like
years,
that. And it was a major part of his existence. And all of a sudden, he's in a room with 3,000 or 4,000 paperback books in a storage locker.
Yeah, and a mattress on the floor. Yeah, that seems to me like a good way to live. All my life, I've had real problem with property anyway, because with property, you have obligations. And with houses and things like that, you have enormous obligations to keep them up and that kind of thing. And so for me, I hardly own anything. And
are you still sleeping on the floor?
Oh, yeah. I'll sleep on the floor. I mean, my life is a real moronic. Well, you know, I got thousands of paperback books, and I got a mattress on the floor, and I got a lot of file cabinets because the things that I treasure, I guess, are simply sort of the records and diaries and journals and correspondence. And
Are you living in an apartment, a room, a house?
No, I have. Now I have a little. It's about 700 square feet, a little old adobe house. That's very simple, to say the least.
Oh, well,
it's got indoor. It does have my old house. You know, I used an outhouse for 20 years, and this one has an indoor toilet. So this is.
And this is a single room home.
Yeah, it has three little rooms. It's 700 square feet. It's probably not much bigger than the studio that we're in.
The house.
Yeah.
But what about the property, the land?
Oh, the property has a little lot around it. There's nothing on it. It's just sort of.
It's not as though you're out in the desert.
No. I'm right in the middle of Taos. It's on a street called Val Verde Street, which is like 300 yards from the Taos Plaza.
But your other house that you.
Oh, it was about a mile outside of
Taos.
But
this was a large property.
1.8 acres. In New York City, that's a lot
of
property.
Large
in New Mexico, which is the fourth largest state in the Union with only 1,500,000 people, that's a teeny piece of land.
Now, you have simplified your life to the degree that you're staying in a small adobe house in a lot, and this is the way you want it.
Oh, yeah. See, I can walk or ride my bike anywhere.
What about the truck?
Well, the truck I take when I go gather wood. You know, I burn wood for heat. And when I go fishing, you know, if I have to cover a long distance, then I use the truck. Sure, you know. I still haven't figured out how to solarize my truck, but maybe that's coming. But I can, you know, I ride my bike to, there are little mountain streams within 5 miles of the house, and I pretty much figure anything within a 10-mile radius you can use a bike.
But you simply walked away from your house after the divorce.
Yeah, I gave it to my ex-wife because it seemed like she could use it more than me. You know, I think that another thing that's always really disturbed me in this country is the culture kind of trains us all to be obsessed with security. And I've always felt like that was a big ripoff. Everybody chases security, and nobody ever, the more property you get, the more burglar alarms you need, the more paranoid you get, you know, but people think I can get enough equity, enough health insurance, enough car insurance, you know, to be secure, but you never really get it. You become more and more insecure that you're going to lose it, you know, and I kind of like the idea, you know, freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose, and there's an enormous sense of, I don't know if you'd call it peace or equanimity, if you're not trying to hang on to stuff, you know. I used to work on film, so I had health insurance through the Writers Guild.
Mm-hmm.
And now I don't work on films anymore, so I don't even have any health insurance.
Why didn't you keep up your membership with the Writers Guild?
Because you got to work on films and earn like something like $20,000 a year.
You can't just pay dues.
No. I even get some residuals from the Writers Guild, but those don't count. You have to be operating on a sort of the original time through order to get health insurance.
Now you have no insurance, but you have a heart condition, and this doesn't worry you?
Nobody will insure me. You know, no commercial insurable. I've got Meniere's disease, asthma, and a bad heart. You know, they just laugh at you. No, it doesn't. I don't know. One of the things it does is it makes you take a little better care of yourself, right? Like eat healthy foods, you know, organic, that kind of stuff. Stay
away
from the booze.
Why can't you join the Authors Guild? They have insurance.
Do they have insurance? I don't know. I don't. The Authors Guild is in New York, yeah. Right?
I think Erica John is president of it.
Really?
And they have a. They go to bat for authors where they can.
Really?
Kind of hard to do. I mean, they've tried to negotiate contracts, union-style contracts with publishing houses, have not been successful because authors are considered freelance.
But true, yeah. No, I know. I remember.
It might be worth an inquiry.
I remember reading about that.
If you could get the insurance policy, you should have it. What would happen if you were to have a heart attack and had to be taken to the hospital? How are you going to finance it?
Well, you know, I'll throw myself on the mercy of the court, you know, and either it'll take care of me or they won't. You know, and that'll be that. It's like
this is what you're saying is not. I interview authors every week, and I have for almost 20 years, and many more, and then you would think, have the same story.
Sure.
Many of them, however, work. They are employed by universities or something like that.
Sure.
Others, no, they've taken the risk as you have to be full-time writers, and sometimes it's paid off. Sometimes it hasn't.
Well, you know, I mean, a lot of people stay in jobs they don't like in order to get health insurance, you know. And it isn't that I don't like working on films, but in 1988 I just decided that I like a lot more writing, you know, literature, working on fiction. And I did think about the fact that the Writers Guild really gives you good health insurance, right, and that I've been sick. And then I just decided that that wasn't a good enough reason to continue doing something that you didn't want to do.
And you wouldn't consider taking a job for the post office?
No. I've been, you know,
what
graduated.
What about the forest ranger?
God forbid, you know. No, I'm a writer. You know, I'm a professional writer. Since 1962, I have earned a living from writing. I mean, that's been it. And this last semester, for the first time in my life, I took a job teaching, a regular job, you know, at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. And I actually, you know, had to go to the office, you know, every week for 5 months. And at the end of the month, I actually got a paycheck, which was, you know, on the 31st of every month, they handed me $2,000. And that was weird. You know, that's the one organized job I've had.
Are you going to continue then?
No. I really loved teaching and I loved the students, but I didn't get much writing done. I found that teaching, if you're really committed to it, is a time and a half or a double-time job.
But a lot of people who do that finally only have classes 3 days a week or something like that.
Yeah, but that's real hard. That's all I did. I had classes 3 days a week, but I prepared an awful lot. And it, to me, it was kind of like having to give three speeches a week. And it costs me an awful lot of energy to get in front of people that way. And I felt really obligated to prepare a lot because one of the courses that I was teaching was a sort of all-inclusive course about, you know, the macroscopic overview of the planet at every level, from human rights, minorities, women's rights, environment, ecology, you know, organic gardening, you name it.
You weren't teaching literature as such.
No.
What if you were to teach a creative writing course? You might have a different perspective.
No. One of the courses I taught was creative writing, and that was even more difficult because I felt an obligation to pay as much attention to their work as I did to my own work. In other words, you know, critique them with the same kind of, I don't know, authority that I would critique my own writing, which meant that it was bloody hard work. I mean, it would take me 5 or 6 hours to read like a 6-page story and go through it, you know, and take it apart and really, really discuss what I thought the problems with it were.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. I took, a year or so ago, I took a writer's workshop at Trinity School, creative writing workshop, where we worked with short stories. And so every week you had to read stories submitted by the class, three or four, and discuss them. Fortunately, I didn't have to do any fresh writing during this period because I'd already written a batch of stories, but I had to read theirs. And it was time-consuming. And then to make copious notes and then to go in and be prepared to discuss it and analyze each story, this class ran for 10 weeks, and I don't think I got any writing done at all myself. It was that time that I really had to spend just working on that workshop. So I know what you're saying. It is time-consuming.
Yeah, it's all right. I at the beginning of the workshop, I suggested they would do three pieces written a number of times, you know, rewritten a number of times. And I think in 5 months we wound up doing sort of 1.5 pieces for each one, rewritten a number of times. Most of them said they'd never worked so hard in their lives. But it was interesting to see people really kind of make leaps forward. And these were all graduate students who were getting masters in creative writing. So
I admire people like you, John, who are unafraid of taking the risk to do what you want to do. Most of us just can't do it. I couldn't do it. I come from a background of business people in the Midwest, oil people.
Yeah.
And my family still thinks that I'm rather suspect being a broadcast journalist.
Well, even that is weird
as far as they're concerned. You know?
Sure.
But to take the kind of risk that you're doing would be unheard of in my family.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, a long time ago, I remember when I started writing, I made a decision that whether I earned $5,000 a year or $100,000 a year, I'd always try and live as if I were earning $5,000 a year, because that way no one could ever stop me from doing what I wanted, because I wouldn't get attached to, you know, I guess mostly material things or obligations that come, you know, with that. And that's pretty much worked over the years. And I've even found that, you know, when I worked for Hollywood for 8 or 9 years, I earned a lot of money. I mean, I would gross anywhere from, you know, 80 or 90 grand a year to 120, 130,000 a year. And I felt real uncomfortable with that, both for personal and political reasons, and I would wind up, you know, redistributing that wealth as fast as I could so that I never came to sort of depend on that kind of income and what it could do for you. You know?
Redistributing it?
Yeah, well, you know, politically, you know, there's, for me, there's such an unequal distribution of wealth around the globe that usually when I come into it, I feel that I ought to redistribute it a lot to friends. Most of my friends in the Taos area are quite poor, you know, a lot poorer than me. And there's a million ways you can help people. There's also a million organizations you can donate money to, both at the local.
You can't do that anymore.
What do you mean?
Well, you said you had a bad heart. Now you're going to have to start putting things away for contingencies, you know, in case you're going to have it. What if you become sick and you can't work, you can't write anymore, you can't publish another book, or you know, you've got to be able to draw on something.
Yeah,
so you've got to put something away.
Don't you figure? I figure we all end up in the gutter, right? It all ends badly, no matter what, you know.
That's true.
And I've had a wonderful life. I mean, I don't mean to sound schmaltzy and Pollyannish. I do think sometimes about putting it in a tin box, but I also think if I start saving money to prepare for the contingency will occur. You know, it's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy. I kind of thought, if I just don't worry too much about it, if I do try and take care of myself better, which involves, you know, getting more rest, slowing your life down, being more simple, eating organic foods. I work a lot on that kind of stuff, exercising, you know, sort of preventive lifestyle instead of preparing for the sickness lifestyle. You might live longer in the long run. I don't know. You know, talk to me when I'm flat on my back in the hospital.
I have a feeling.
Screaming
I don't think it matters what you're going to do. Medical emergency is going to happen no matter if you prepare or not. It's like these
sure.
great, some of the, read the obituaries, these great athletes in their 50s, early 60s, you think they're going to live a lifetime because they took such good care of themselves and they dropped dead of heart attack.
Yeah.
And a dissipated guy who smokes and drinks. My father smoked and drank all of his life. He's 85. His mental state is not very good, but his vital signs are.
Sure.
And he used to say, if I knew I was going to live this long, I would have taken better care of myself.
No, I got friends. I always get amazed, you know, because given my physical condition at 52, and I try and take care of myself, and I do have friends that are total reprobates, and they smoke and they drink, and there's nothing wrong with them, right? If I smoked a cigarette, I'd probably drop dead on the spot. So,
how do you orient your day? You do write every day.
Oh, yeah.
And what kinds of projects are you working on? Well, of course, we know from your latest novel what you've done last, but what sort of projects as a rule in general do you work on?
I have, there's another book I've just finished, the production of it, that Norton's going to bring out called Keep It Simple, a photo essay book. It's the second part of a trilogy. The first book was called The Sky's the Limit, which Norton published in 1990. And then the third one is called The Holiness of Water, and it'll come out in 93. And sort of the first episode of that, which is photographs and writing, just got published in New Mexico Magazine.
Do you take the photographs?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've done five books of my own photographs now, with essays accompanying them. And later this afternoon, I'm going to go talk with my editor, who's just read another draft of sort of a big novel I've been working on for 4 years, and she will probably tell me that it continues to be a disoriented, rotten, no good for nothing book, but that I'm making progress, and I think I am. And I have two small books that I've been sort of scribbling on while I've been flying around the country. I just sort of write by hand in notebooks. And they're two sort of shorter novel projects, at least for the moment they seem shorter. And so, you know, that's kind of a full slate.
Yeah. I would guess that at the age of 52, you're not the kind of guy with this life behind you to run out of ideas.
No. It's the problem isn't running out of ideas. The problem is making a decision on which ideas are the best one that you should pursue. And that's always the toughest decision, because every time you decide to pursue an idea, it's, you know, 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years of your life. So the hardest part is just making the decision on where to go. No, I have so many ideas that I can't see straight. You know, it's been hard for me to sleep at night during this kind of whirlwind tour, because I keep turning on the lamps and scribbling down more stuff. I kind of keep myself sane, I guess, while I'm going from city to city by trying to concentrate off and on these projects, you know. So it's a good kind of mental exercise, and it keeps up momentum too.
And your 5,000 paperback books in that storage locker, I hope you got them out.
Well, there's still a lot of them in that locker.
What good is that?
Well, you know, I've got to build sheds and things like that.
You got to build bookshelves, is what you got to do.
I got to build bookshelves, and I got to get places to store them. Yeah, I've never thrown away a book since I was 16. I think I hang on to them religiously. I underline everything I read. I seem to refer to it. It's the one thing I treasure, you know, talking about property, are those books. You know, I find myself, I guess I've lived a lot of my life vicariously through the literature, you know, of people I've loved. And it's almost like I've never met a book I didn't like that didn't have something in it that was some kind of reference that made life a little bit richer and that I might want to refer to later. It's funny.
Yeah, I have a store. Well, I'm closing out a storage locker that I have here in Manhattan, and I brought down 15 boxes of books to my apartment, and bookshelf just moved into a new apartment.
Uh-huh.
And I hadn't seen some of these books for years. And I had things like my high school yearbook, my college yearbook, and I didn't know, you know, it was not a good way of owning books to be separated from them, because you really want these things around.
Oh, yeah.
That you can pick up and look at, even if you don't reread them. And a lot of them I'm seeing as old friends. And I said, gee, I've been reunited with old friends. I'm glad I brought them back.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I love books. And I also really like the books because of the particular edition and the cover. Most of them are paperbacks, right? But, you know, I got paperbacks of, I don't know, To Have and Have Not and things like that in their second printing or third printing, you know, garish little covers and stuff, and I love them. Yeah. And then one of the great problems with my recent marriage was that you know, when we moved in together, I had to put half my books in storage, you know, and they weren't sitting around there simmering every day, sort of, with their friendly little confines. They were in cardboard boxes, you know, out in storage
lockers. Get back
to
Taos, get some plywood and some brackets.
Oh, yes, no, I'm good at that.
And start putting those shelves up, get those books out.
Oh, yeah.
Get them around you.
I will.
Well, Elegy for September, it's got some beautiful things in it. It's certain that the main character in this book, as you do, obviously, has a feeling for nature and the desert and the mountains, and it's all in that book. It's very, very nicely done by
Thanks.
John Nichols. Thank you very much, John.
Thank you.